Okay, good morning to all of you. Welcome. This is the panel on China and North Korea with a specific theme on North Korea's nuclear program. As I just said, I welcome all of you, and also I'm delighted to meet the panelists. I will be very short in brief in my introductory remarks because you are here to listen to the guests. My name is Steve Chan. I am a college professor of distinction at this university. My home department is political science, and I also am the director for Fairroom RAP. Let me introduce the three panelists, and I will do so in alphabetic order. Lawrence Brown, sitting next to me. He just flew in from Beijing, I think. Just for this event, so we are very grateful for his presence here. He's an international lawyer and also a developmental economist. He's been very active in promoting multilateral dialogue on various topics, but especially on climate change. You have been very much involved in the issue of climate change or global warming. He has been recognized with awards from the Chinese government, where in China he has worked for a few years, and he's been dedicating his work to environmental protection. Of course, his expertise extends beyond the environment. Our next guest, maybe I should do it by the way we are seated. So Peter is the next person. Peter Robert Lighty, did I pronounce your last name?
Light,
I'm sorry. Light. He is a retired founding chair of J.P. Morgan Chase Bank in China. He's a banker, but he has also been an academic, having studied Asian history, right, and taught in various places, including Oberlin and Middlebury, two very distinguished liberal arts colleges, and he has written two books. May I ask what are the titles of these two books?
One of them is called Pieces of China, some very quirky stories of our early years in China. And the second one is called A Host of Memories, which are more quirky stories, not in China.
Okay, but, so we're very much looking, we are looking forward to your comments on North Korea and China. And last but not least, sitting at the far end of the table, is Joe Siriccioni. He is the president for the Plowshares Fund, and he's an expert on the prevention of nuclear proliferation, on nuclear weapons in general. Having worked in very many different roles, distinguished roles, in Washington, D.C., including serving on the Committee of Armed Services, on the staff of the Committee on Armed Services in the House of Representatives. He has been an advisor, a member of the advisory board for the Secretary of State. So Joe comes to us with, again, a very distinguished record of service to the community and to the government of the United States. So welcome, Joe, and again, we appreciate your presence here. To all the three panelists, welcome. I have to tell you about one more thing before I invite the panelists to make their comments. In this CW session, we will be utilizing notebook system, a note card system. So if you have questions, I guess I'm asking the audience to submit your questions on a note card. And you may raise your hand at any time to request a note card. There are people around with note cards, and they will give you a pencil, and then you can give your written note card back to the producer. And if you're a student, please note that you are a student on the note card, so we will consider that that factor in sequencing the questions. And including your name in the note card, and if you select a question, we will recognize you, and you can ask your question aloud, okay? So make sure that your name shows up on the note card, okay? So without further ado, let me, if I may suggest, I think Joe has volunteered to start off, and then we will have Lawrence, and then maybe Peter will wrap things up for us. Maybe we can have each of you speak maybe for 15 minutes, and then you can respond to each other.
Maybe a little less than that.
Even a less,
maybe more like 10.
That's great.
To get things going, okay?
That would leave more time for the audience who have been very good standing even to ask questions and participate in this this session. That's great. So
great.
The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So Donald Trump tweets this morning. North Korea is looking for trouble. This is 3 hours ago. North Korea is looking for trouble. If China decides to help, that would be great. If not, we will solve the problem without them, ! USA. Followed by, I explained to the president of China that a trade deal with the U.S. will be far better for them if they solve the North Korean problem. You can say a lot in 140 characters. And these two tweets say a lot about how he sees the relationship with China, about how he sees the connection with economics and international relations. I wouldn't call it diplomacy, but diplomatic relations from him, his point of view, his view of how we can solve this by ourselves. I'm going to talk just a little bit about this and give you kind of an overview of the problem. And I love the title of this panel because, yeah, this gets real complicated real quick. Walter Pincus writes a column this morning, the famous Washington Post reporter, writes a column this morning worried that Trump may have learned the wrong lessons from Syria, that he may now feel that this demonstration of toughness, of resolve, which was popular with politicians, popular with the journalists who were gushing over this. Not as popular as I thought it would be with the public, but still popular enough. Roughly somewhere between 51% and 57% of the public approve of this, and that's the result mainly of a surge in Republican support for the approval of this. The Republican Party is 86% approved of this, only 38% of Democrats approved of the strike. But still a very popular move, and it helped him at a very difficult time. So he may feel he can now do this, as some advisors are urging him to do, with North Korea or Iran. That would be stupid. The difference between Syria, North Korea, and Iran is that North Korea and Iran shoot back. So you take an attack on North Korea, you seek a kinetic solution, as we say now, to the problem, they're going to have a kinetic response. And this is going to spiral out of control very quickly, very quickly. There, you basically have three options when you're dealing with North Korea. One is the military option. And the problem isn't just that North Korea has enough material for about 20 nuclear bombs right now. We don't know exactly, but about 20 bombs. And they have. It's not just that they have hundreds of short and medium aim range rockets that can hit South Korea and Japan. It's not just that they probably have been able to, what they call, miniaturize the warhead to fit on those missiles, so they probably have a credible nuclear attack option for South Korea and Japan. They don't have a long-range missile, by the way, that can hit the United States yet, but they're working on it. The problem isn't just that you're worried as the North that if we attack North Korea that they will attack our allies with nuclear weapons or attack us. The North Korean press today is saying that they will nuke the United States should we strike first, reacting to the news that the USS Carl Vinson, an aircraft carrier battle group, is steaming on Trump's orders towards the Korean Peninsula right now. The problem is the conventional power that North Korea has. They have 10,000 rockets and artillery tubes within range of Seoul. Estimates are that within the first few hours of a war, hundreds of thousands of South Koreans would die. This is the most heavily militarized area on the face of the earth. So anything could just set off that tinderbox. That's what you're worried about. Either intentional or by a miscalculation, an overestimation of your threats, of your ability to intimidate the other side. So the first option is a military option. I would say there is no military solution. Even saying it's an option is misleading. You really don't have a military option with North Korea, even though you will read many, many columns with people talking about what we might do or urging a preemptive strike. I think that's just posturing. The second option you have is negotiate. And I personally believe there is a negotiated solution, but we're at deadlock right now because the U.S. wants to negotiate about North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons, and North Korea will never agree to that, and they want to agree, they want to negotiate about the U.S. leaving the Korean Peninsula, which we're not going to do. So we can't agree on what the talks are about, and we've been stuck on that for years now. The Obama administration completely failed to solve this problem. They inherited it from the Bush administration. North Korea went nuclear in 2006, had its first test in 2006 when George W. Bush was president. His policy of toughness failed. But Obama's policy, what he calls strategic patience, waiting for North Korea to come to the bargaining table, or thinking some combination of sanctions and tough talk and make them come to the bargaining table, also failed. The problem got much worse during the Obama administration. And the testing regime has been accelerated in the last couple of years. This program, nuclear and ballistic missiles in full gear, if we do nothing, if we do not solve this problem, it's highly likely that by the end of the first term of the Trump administration, or whatever administration it is in 4 years, by the end of the Trump administration in 4 years, that North Korea will have a missile that can hit the United States, will have a nuclear warhead that can go on it, and that nuclear warhead will probably be a hydrogen bomb, not the atomic bombs they now have. That's why there's so much attention on China. If both of those two options are difficult, well, then you need China. Will China solve the problem for us? And this is an illusion, to think that China is somehow going to lean on North Korea enough to solve it. Yes, the Chinese could shut down the North Korean economy overnight. No, they won't do that. They don't want a North Korea causing trouble in their neighborhood. They have no problem with North Korea being a thorn in the side of the Japanese and the South Koreans and the U.S. That's fine with them. But they don't want North Korea to be causing so much trouble that it justifies a Japanese military buildup, a U.S. military buildup, the deployment of missile defenses in South Korea that China sees it as aimed at them, not without cause. That's what they don't want. They don't want to see aircraft carriers steaming into their seas. So they'd like Kim Jong-un to pull back. They don't want him to do another test, and it's widely rumored that he might do one as soon as April 15th, the anniversary of his grandfather's birthday, a day when North Korea traditionally does things like this, shoots off missiles, does nuclear tests, which is why the aircraft carrier is steaming. But here's where it gets complicated, and I'm just going to give you one example because these guys sitting next to me know this so much better than me. A couple of weeks ago, Kim Jong-un, by all accounts, ordered the assassination of his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam. Not a particularly bright guy, didn't really have a political role. He was walking through Kuala Lumpur Airport. Two women rushed up to him, put a rag over his face, and apparently sprayed it with VX, a deadly nerve agent, more deadly than the sarin that was just used in the Korean attack. Kim Jong-nam convulses, dies minutes later, hours later. Now, this is a little like Michael Corleone knocking off Fredo in The Godfather. Harmless guy, but he posed a threat to the regime. He posed a threat to the regime. Why? He was an hereditary heir in an hereditary generational leadership that has dominated North Korea since the Korean War. Mm-hmm. Got to get rid of him. Here's the thing you may not know. Kim Jong-nam was under China's protection. This was China's guy. He was living in Macau. He was protected by China. So this is like knocking off this other mafia family's guy. But it's China. Kim Jong-un didn't care. In fact, Kim Jong-un has been killing people friendly to China in his government since the beginning, starting with his uncle, who he killed, who was China's guy. He was the one who was going to make sure this young untested leader didn't get out of control. In fact, by my count, I think Kim Jong-un has killed over 200 generals and high-ranking officials, sometimes in very brutal ways, strapping them to artillery guns and blowing their bodies apart. In a complete, you know, insult to the, not just killing him, but insulting him, not giving the family a body to properly dispose of. And why is he doing this? You might think he's crazy. A lot of people talk of Kim Jong-un as crazy. No, I don't think he's crazy. Crazy is when you do something that's not in your interest, like running naked in the street. This stuff works for him. This is rational. He is still in power. His family is still in power. What's the lesson he draws from Syria? Don't give up your weapons. That's what he says happened to Muammar Gaddafi. Gave up his weapons. Look what happened. U.S. killed him. Saddam Hussein gave up his weapons. By the way, there were no WMD in Iraq in 2003. Saddam had given them up after 91. You give up your weapons, the U.S. will kill you. So he is not going to give up those nuclear weapons. What does he want? What he wants is security. We were talking about, not necessarily security for the country, but security for the regime. That's what nuclear weapons give you. That is your deterrent. You attack me, I'm going to blow up your cities. So that's what he wants, prestige. Can he get that? Can he get that from the U.S.? He could. There is a deal to be made here. We'll talk about this more in the Q&A maybe. There is a deal to be made here, and Donald Trump could do it. Donald Trump could make a deal that freezes the program, not eliminates it, but you might be able to get a freeze to the program, stop it short of creating a missile that can hit the United States, short of creating an H-bomb. That would be a good thing. But he would still have these weapons, and then we'll talk over the time whether we could reassure him and give him security and other means that we are not coming after him, that we are not going to change his regime, that we can come to terms with him, that we can actually sign a peace treaty with North Korea. There is no peace treaty. The Korean War is actually not officially over. It never ended. Officially, we're in a truce. We never negotiated an end to the war. Give him that. You want prestige? A photo of Kim Jong-un with Donald Trump would be huge prestige. It'd be a little weird. Short,
tall. Who's their barber?
Who's their barber? The hair, we'd be talking about the hair. But it would be hugely prestigious. And so that is worth something. And that, I would say that is worth a lot. And can China help bring that about? Yes, but they are never going to press North Korea so hard that that regime collapses. Because as much as they don't want him to be causing trouble, as much as they're ticked off at what he's doing, they don't want to see that regime collapse. They don't want a catastrophe on the peninsula. They don't want to see millions of refugees streaming into Chinese provinces to the north, destabilizing those provinces. They don't want to see South Korea coming and taking over North Korea and consolidating a U.S.-allied government over all of Korea, maybe with nuclear weapons. They don't want to see that. They're trying to maneuver a soft landing, as they say. Not a hard landing, a soft landing. And so that's why when Trump talks to them, are you willing to help? They say back to him, are you willing to talk? Are you willing to talk? So if Trump is willing to talk, if this bluster, if this aircraft carrier is just Trump tactics to create leverage, okay. But if he gets fooled into thinking that there is a solution to this that involves aircraft carriers and missiles and preemptive strikes, then we are in very dangerous territory, my friends. Very dangerous territory.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. That was really excellent. I'm just going to try and elaborate on some of the things that you said, and I agree very much with your points. But I'm going to also offer maybe some somewhat counterintuitive views from the ground, which will be different than the perspective I think you get through the mainstream media here. First of all, one of the things that Joe raised was, you know, why should China solve it? Why should they put pressure on North Korea? And there's a very simple reason why they will not, because of cost. We have all of our troops lined up on the northern border of South Korea. It's a huge cost for our taxpayer. We're there. We've set the SOD missiles, which China doesn't want. And frankly, the cost of underwriting North Korea as an economy is nothing. It's really cheap. So effectively, the North Korean army is keeping us very busy, keeping our politics, keeping our politicians in Washington uptight and in antics, and it's a very low cost for China. So it's money is the first thing. The second thing is, I agree with Joe, China's not the solution. We are the solution. We are actually the solution to this whole problem. And the photograph of Donald Trump with Kim Jong-un would probably be the answer. And how do we get there? And let me explain it in a couple of contexts. The first is politics in, I'll say, our side of the world, in Asia, in East Asia, is for keeps. It's a zero-sum game. You either win in your dynastic politics or you die, and you die very badly. And so in that dynastic politics, you don't have transitions. When we kick a president out and we bring another one in, the new administration comes and people go along with the game. But that doesn't happen there because, as Peter will talk about, and he's an expert on Confucian history, that Confucian psychology is their political psychology. So the Kim dynasty is a Confucian feudal dynasty in terms of its structure. They may wear, you know, kind of Soviet-style clothes, but it doesn't mean anything. That's what they are. And so the reality then is generations of generals, because when Kim Il-sung took power with Stalin's support, China's support, he had around him a coterie of generals, and it was army first. When his son took power, Kim Jong-il, he then had the problem of being surrounded by his father's generals. So he couldn't tell them what to do. Absolute power is only it's only a theater. So he actually wanted to reform. And during the Clinton administration, Madeleine Albright went to North Korea. There were initial attempts to open relations with the United States. Actually, all of these communist regimes want to open up relations with us and do business. That is the truth. That's the reality. And I'll come back and I'll reflect on my experience, because I've worked in the transition of a number of communist economies toward market, and I see how quickly it changes. So I'll reflect on that in a minute, and then you can see what the future of North Korea could look like. Okay, so the father wants to have relations. The father is using very bad tactics. He kidnaps someone. Al Gore has to go over. I mean, you know, this stuff goes on and on. But ultimately, the problem is they are walking a tightrope between wanting to be really tough for the generals, because they don't want a coup d'etat, and to show that they're strong and they can lead, and at the same time open up and adopt China's reforms, which are basically all market reforms now. So it's a real tough act for them to play if they have sanctions against them, and if they're a pariah regime, which only reinforces this pariah status. So Kim Jong-un takes over, and all the reports that I have had is that initially he wanted to really reform. He really wanted to follow. They were attempting to put in place, I think, half a dozen special economic zones along the border of China, wanting to bring in Chinese investment. But the problem is, now he's surrounded by two levels of generals, his father's and his father's grandfather's. So the only way he can do anything is to get absolute control. Now, I'll reflect on this in Chinese politics. You may remember Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping wanted reform, but Deng Xiaoping was part of the Long March. He was part of that, they say, second generation. He was really a first generation of revolutionaries. But he could not do anything without getting Mao's marshals behind him. So it was a struggle for power within the military before he could initiate reforms, and he couldn't push, after one decade of reforms, he couldn't push anything through until 1992, when he actually then, it was an orchestrated trip to the South. And to a great extent, it was the military behind him that allowed him to push that forward, because they had a stake in it, business-wise. Jiang Zemin was the successor. And when John Zemin took power, Deng Xiaoping appointed Liu Huaqing as the general to take care of Jiang. Problem is, Liu Huaqing's a long marcher. John Zemin's not part of the military. John Zemin had years to consolidate power and to get rid of generals after generals and reappoint generals, one of whom is Xu Caihou, who was just taken down by Xi Jinping for corruption. So each time the leader has to clear out, okay, sorry, John Zemin took down Liu Huaqing, corruption. Okay, each time, in China they use corruption because everybody's corrupt, it's very easy to arrest, okay? It's just an easy one, you know? But in North Korea, it's more dynastic, so they take them out and they shoot them. There's a Chinese saying, both Peter and Steve will know, you know. It comes from one of the classics of military strategy, the Romance of Three Kingdoms. Cao Cao, who is the general in the end who wins, says, "Ning jiao wo fu tian xia ren, bu jiao tian xia ren fu wo." I will slaughter everyone under heaven, than allowing one person to challenge my authority. So when you think and you listen to all those guys in Washington, the think tanks at Brookings and Wilson analyzing Chinese politics, just remember that one sentence. You don't have to waste any time reading their books. Okay? All its complexity, it's that simple. Okay, so now Kim Jong-un's facing a problem. He's trying to slaughter any possible competition around him, and the only way to do is kill him, and then to reappoint new generals to get enough power. But ultimately, what he wants is to open the economy. Well, let me tell you plans that are at work. You've heard of China's One Belt, One Road policy, the New Silk Road. It includes North Korea, and it includes South Korea. South Korea is China's, the largest trading partner with South Korea is China. The largest investor in South Korea is China. There are more Koreans living in Beijing than any other foreign group. China will bring peace to the Korean Peninsula with money. And the plans are for China Railway Corporation to go right through North Korea and for developing port facilities along the coast, which are craved by Russia and Mongolia because they want to export minerals. And they need that non-ice northern port desperately. So now you're talking about possibility of economic zones in the north, where China's population on the China side of the border is ethnically Korean. They speak Korean in addition to Chinese, and they eat kimchi and they have all these customs because they're actually Korean by ethnicity. So there's a lot of interest in opening up North Korea's economy. And the only country that can do that is us, by lifting sanctions, going in. And what does Kim want? Of course he wants a market economy. But, first of all, remember, he wants to be in power. So you, rather than coming in and saying, well, we have to bring you democracy first, and then we have to have elections, and blah, 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 and all this stuff that we've done all over Africa and South America, and it's basically turned everybody against us. Basically, they just want to do business and probably guarantee his authority at least for a period of time. And put them up on the pedestal. I mean, you know, that's what he wants, ultimately. And for his coterie of people who are loyal to him. So if we're going to have regime change, this is not going to work. It's going to backfire, as Joe said. And I want to just reflect for a moment of what that could look like, because I came to China in 81. I think, Peter, you came in 82? Is that 78. So he was even before me. In 78, 76, China was still supporting the Khmer Rouge. It was a radical leftist regime in the 70s. When I arrived in 81, there was no food and there was no clothes. Everybody wore blue or green. That was it. If you were a worker, it was blue. If it was a soldier, you were green. And as a student, we were lucky we got to eat some fat, pork fat, no food. Okay, I remember those days really, really clearly. And the transformation, today I look out at Beijing, my God. It is so far ahead in terms of where we are, in terms of infrastructure, where China is. And they are as capitalist as they can be. Two other regimes I've worked with. I was in Laos as advisor to the central bank, and I drafted all the financial reform policies for Laos
in 1990, 91, 92. And that was, again, the Hermit Kingdom, the Pathet Lao. Khaesan was still alive, the Mao figure who came out of the jungle. And look at Laos today. It's like Thailand. Vietnam. I was also central bank governor advisor in Vietnam. I worked on the first privatizations in Vietnam. We called them corporatization because you couldn't say privatization because it wasn't so. I coined the term corporatization, which China now uses. In fact, look at Vietnam today. I was one of the early businessmen going to Vietnam when there were sanctions, and we were doing it illegally. And I remember with other American businessmen who were also defying the sanctions, we used to write letters to George Bush Sr. after he vomited on the Japanese prime minister, on the Vietnam, Air Vietnam vomit bags, requesting that he lift sanctions so we can be competitive with all the Singaporeans and Hong Kongese and Taiwanese who are running and doing business in Vietnam. Look at Vietnam today. And I'll just use another example. I went into Cambodia. I was also central bank advisor in Cambodia with the very first UN peacekeeping team that went into Angkor Wat, Siem Reap, in, I guess that was 92. And you had kids running around with AK-47s and rocket launchers. It was just insane. But lifting sanctions, opening up an economy, it becomes transformed very, very quickly. And when people are busy making money and busy getting ahead, they don't have time to be radical, and they're not interested in that stuff. They're not interested in it at all. I'll give you one last story. As I also worked as a mediator between the Maoists when they came out of the jungle in Nepal. And a couple of years ago, there's two communist parties in Nepal now. Now it's a democratic system. One is the Maoists and one is the United Marxist-Leninist. And one of the Maoist leaders brought me into their headquarters, and they have Marx, Lenin, Mao, all the pictures on the wall. And Stalin, and they asked me, why are the Chinese working more with the UMLO, the United Marxist-Leninists, than us? I said, because they're businessmen. They say it, but they don't do it. You guys believe in it. The Chinese are not interested in this. They say it. Oh, Marx, Lenin, Mao said, you know, we can get rich. And so my point with this is, let's open up, let's cut the sanctions on conditions of having first mover advantage for investment in North Korea. Let's open up some zones there. Let's come in with business and turn that place around the way we should have done with Cuba a long time ago, because heck, the Chinese are the largest investor in Cuba. How did we let that happen when you can swim there from Key West? They came all the way around the world, dominate the Cohiba market. How could we let that happen? I'm sure you all enjoy Cohiba cigars. So, on that note, I hope that one day Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un will enjoy a Cohiba together.
Nice rescue. Thank you, Maurice. With that last line. Looping it together.
That's very good. Very good. Excellent. We now turn to Peter.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back again. And I'd like to wish you all a happy Passover.
Thank you.
I could also use an antidepressant after listening to these two, but let's move on.
See what I got.
I think it's very important to realize that I think we're talking about three stories. There's a local story, there's a regional story, and there's an international story. The local story sort of plays to the audience of, well, let the Chinese lean on Korea and they can fix it. I think that's, if you're very myopic, that's a credible solution. And then if you sort of move back a little further, you see, well, the South Korea is there, and that makes China nervous, and Japan is there, and that makes China nervous. So those are two enemies surrounding China, which does not bode well and causes tremendous discomfort. The Chinese like the fact that they have, dare I say, friend on their border, which is a friend that nobody really wants, which is North Korea, but it's better than a united Korean peninsula. And they really don't want to bring down their friend because they will have a refugee problem from Korea, the likes of which is unimaginable. So that's a non-starter. So then you step back a little further and you talk about a regional story. I think it's very important to recognize that China is completely surrounded by enemies in Asia. It does not have one friend on its border, except, you got it, North Korea, which is some honor. So, and I think unintended consequences of recent American policies have made the idea of China becoming a regional power amongst its enemies more feasible. With our pivot to Asia in the Obama administration, we inadvertently gave up our foothold in that part of the world. We declined to become part of a regional agency, and we also excluded China from becoming part of a regional agency. And then, plus the fact, we've really been dealt out of that part of the world now. It's a great shame, a tremendous shame. I mean, dealt out in terms of being on the ground involved, as we should be, commensurate with our history in that part of the world and where we should be going. I think if America would realize that we're confronting now a Monroe Doctrine in that part of the world, which is something really interesting to think about. We don't think about the Monroe Doctrine being a heinous bit of policy in our part of the world. It just comes with the territory, and we're a big power here, and we hold sway, or did hold sway, over a great part of this hemisphere. What's the big deal? Suddenly, when that becomes a possibility in the Far East, we get our knickers in a twist. But that is part of the story now, and we have to confront it. So the further you step back, the smaller North Korea gets, despite the fact that it's so problematic. And now we get to the international story, and we have we had regime change here, and we have a president who wants simply to make deals. You trade off a problem in Korea, and you get better trade. I think this is a really dangerous way of looking at the world, and I'm fearful about this, and I would hope that the scenarios that are being discussed on either side of me aim for the light side rather than the dark side, because it's very endangered now. We're in a very dangerous situation, not only because of the regime in North Korea, but because of the regime in Washington. It's a fearful time. I would have a lot more to say if these guys weren't smarter than I was and said it already. So, there you go. Let's have some questions. By the way, I would just like to say one thing. With respect to what Lawrence said, I suspect that Confucius is spinning in his grave now, being mentioned in the same breath with the Kim dynasty.
So before we open up for discussion, questions, and answers, I wonder whether Joe and Lawrence want to react to each other's and Peter's comments, anything that you want to add or amplify, anything at all you want to say?
Well, I want to ask Lawrence a question, actually. You know, as you were talking, I thought, are we getting in our own way here in Asia? I mean, we still have this military, I never actually thought about it this way, but we still have this military posture.
Thank you.
That's as if we're still in the Cold War, that we're holding back the Sino-Soviet bloc from advancing. And so that's why we're in South Korea. That's why we said we had to fight in Vietnam. That's why we're military bases in the Philippines. So we had this base structure that was all aimed at containment, at keeping all that out. And I'm wondering if we got out of the way in Korea, would the North, the South Koreans, and the Chinese actually solve this problem? I don't know the answer. I was wondering how it looks to you from Beijing.
Asians are pragmatic. The other thing is politics in Asia works in its own way. We are always projecting our political view. Even when you read the journalists talking about Chinese politics, it's always two factions. A liberal faction and a conservative. And this is not true. There are many factions. It's very complicated. It's not that at all.
Sorry. I just would like to say something that is important to me. I really think we need to demythologize the Orientals.
Yeah.
I think the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese are knowable. If you look at the extent and the depths of the American relationship with China, it is very, very impressive. And this was crafted by people who supposedly didn't know anything about China or who can't understand China. I think it serves China well to mythologize itself. Just one significant point. The Chinese are learning English in droves to a very, very high standard, which makes it easier for the Americans not to study Chinese, which further leads to mythologizing the Chinese even more, because the best way to learn about the Chinese is to learn the language. Otherwise, you get handled. And I really believe the smoke and mirror stuff with the Chinese, and they're different, and they're this, they're that, and the Koreans, that these people are knowable, and we need to figure them out, and they need to figure us out as well.
Well, Jared and Ivanka's kids are learning Chinese.
Oh, I feel so much better now.
I'll just add that the Chinese, as I've done a lot of work in Africa, Chinese working there know Swahili. And I've done work in the Middle East, and I was involved with the early attempt of Xi Jinping to bring Abbas and Netanyahu into the same room. I was involved in the sort of warm-up for that in Palestine and in Jerusalem, back and forth. But my point is, Chinese diplomats there all speak Arabic fluently.
So in this regard, I just should quickly mention that at this university and elsewhere, the language departments are in trouble, quote-unquote, because enrollments are dropping like crazy. Humanities also, in general. More and more students are going to STEM instead of going to the humanities and learning language. So that reflects poorly on what you have just said.
I'll just add to that on the Korean Peninsula, bringing it full circle to where we are again. You know, back to Joe's question, can they solve the problem themselves? Just put it in another perspective. Chosun University, I was invited there to speak on a conference on this subject, on North Korea. And I was shocked at how beautiful and modern this university was. And I was given a tour of it, and I was told that the largest foreign enrollment, the majority, a huge source of the tuition money, is coming from Chinese going there to learn Korean. And I said, my only comment to you is, all of your first floor classrooms that are facing the nice sort of walkway area should be abandoned and turned into shops for Prada, Louis Vuitton, and all those things, because the students will buy them all out. And you'll make more money as a university. But that idea didn't go over very well with the faculty. But I think that I'll also just come back on, Joe mentioned the Asia pivot.
Yeah.
And this thing, we all kind of smirked at this, from this side, from Asia, looking out at it, because Obama initiated, or the Obama administration initiated, this idea of TPP that would be a regional trading arrangement, and China would not be part of it. And the purpose of this was strategically so that we would set the rules and that they would not set the rules. Now, how can you do that when China's the largest trading partner of every country in the region, and not only the largest trading partner, but it has ethnic Chinese who are running the businesses of Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore. I guess I mentioned Indonesia. I mean, but you know, I used to go into meetings with the board of directors at Bangkok Bank, and they all spoke Chinese, Tejo dialect. I mean, so they're the force in Southeast Asia. Now you're going to eliminate them so we can set the rules. A few years later, we're out of TPP, China has taken over TPP, and China's setting the rules. So there's a Chinese saying for this in the 36 strategies, Fan Ke Wei Zhu, the guest becomes the host. And that's exactly what's happened. Again, you don't need to read the stuff in Brookings, just read the Confucius and the 36 strategies and the War of Three Kingdoms. But my point is, these are policies that are being thought out in think tank laboratories in Washington, D.C., where they make really bad coffee. And one of the things I've noticed over the years is when you meet with officials or you meet with these think tank people, and I've been invited to Washington quite a few times to talk, it's always the conversation goes like this. If I was Xi Jinping, or if I was Jiang Zemin, or if I was, I would do this. But that's not how they think. They have their own logic, which is based on circumstances and their view of their politics, their world, which may not be the way we think. That's why I say we're always projecting consciously our ideas onto them. It doesn't work that way. That's not how they think. And so a lot of our errors are made, not by knowing, but by assuming.
So before we open it up for discussions, questions and answers, I just want to add very briefly 2 points. You know, Sun Tzu, the Chinese military philosopher, used to say, know thyself and know thy enemy, and you can win every battle. We sometimes do not know ourselves very well. I agree with Peter that the Orientals are knowable, but sometimes we need to know ourselves better. And my worry in this conversation is that we may commit the problem, the mistake of rhetorical trap. We become so obsessed with North Korea, we exaggerate so much its importance that we box ourselves into a corner so that we have to act. I remember the days of Vietnam, we exaggerated the importance of fighting the Vietnamese communists in Vietnam instead of at Golden Gate Bridge, right? And therefore we commit our prestige and credibility to doing that. In the end, of course, we forfeited both Vietnam and our credibility. So that's important, rhetorical trap, the escalation of rhetoric. The other thing is something that I think both Joe and Lawrence kind of alluded to, which is that if you think about the axis of evil, right? Iran, Iraq, North Korea. The United States did attack Iraq, and it turned out that Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. The United States did reach an accord with Tehran, Iran, to put a stop to its nuclear program. And we know definitely that North Korea has nuclear weapons. Add to this mix Libya, which was mentioned. Colonel Gaddafi gave up voluntarily his material for making weapons of mass destruction. He dismantled that under international inspection. And we all know what happened to him, right? So you don't have to be Oriental, you just have to use logic. And the logic is that if you do not have nuclear weapons, it's dangerous to your survival, right? In fact, if we wanted to discourage countries from proliferating nuclear weapons, what we have done is to send exactly the opposite message. So, any last words, Joe, Lawrence?
I couldn't agree with you more. And Joe and I, we were having this discussion yesterday. We almost assured by toppling Gaddafi after he gave up nuclear weapons, almost guaranteed at that moment that North Korea would develop them.
What does North Korea want? It wants survival. It wants to have a guarantee that the regime will go on. That's what it wants.
And this is, it isn't like there's a wave of proliferation going on in the world, that many, many countries are getting nuclear weapons, more and more countries. No, that's not what's happening at all. There are fewer countries getting nuclear weapons now than there were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. The policies of Republicans and Democrats have basically worked. We've been reducing nuclear stockpiles in the world from those who have them. We've cut the numbers of nuclear weapons in the world by about 75%. Many, many countries have given up their programs. We had a very bad solution in Iraq, but Iraq does not have this program. We negotiated a deal with Iran. I mean, you want to see a model for how you solve the North Korean problem? Look at what we did with Iran. We negotiated a deal, a win-win solution, another Chinese phrase, a win-win solution. They gained, we gained. Both of our core equities were satisfied, and they rolled back their program. North Korea is actually the last proliferation problem. It's the last one. If you can resolve this, if you can stop this, you're talking about the end of proliferation, this wave that began with the bombing of Hiroshima 72 years ago. And it's right there. There is a deal that could be made here. Donald Trump could do this. And by the way, he's better positioned to make this deal than Barack Obama was. Why? Because he's smarter. Because he's a Republican. And Republicans can make deals that Democrats can't. And it's just a political fact of life. The Republican Party will trust a Republican president to make the deal. The Democrats will support it. You can win approval in the Senate for your deal. Republican presidents tend to have more of the public confidence in their strategic and military positions. So Trump can make this deal. He could solve this problem. He said during the campaign, I'll talk to Kim Jong-un. Sure, why not?
Did he know who he was?
That was a low blow, Peter. You're just sticking it in.
Couldn't help
it. Come
on. I've been very polite.
So he thinks of himself as the great deal maker. So this is one of the opportunities that he has for him. He makes this deal, he goes down in history. He goes down in history for doing this, for solving this problem. Is he willing to do it? Is he willing to use this leverage that he's building up with aircraft carriers and tough talk and China pressure? Is he willing to use this to put it together in a formula that gets China involved, that opens the door? And this is what's so dangerous. He's clearly increasing the pressure on North Korea. If you're going to back North Korea into a corner, you better open a door and give them a way out.
Thank you.
Because otherwise, you're heading for war.
So we have
questions.
Yeah, we have some very good questions from the audience. And by the way, if you want to contribute a question, please raise your hand, and people will bring to you these note cards. Sure. Okay. Sure. No, it's my fault. First question, and it's directed at the panel. It's a wonderful question. Excellent question. You know, at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a deal was made, although not publicized, between the Russians and the Americans, that Kennedy promised Khrushchev that the United States would not invade Cuba if Russia were to remove the missiles from Cuba. Why can't the United States, or South Korea and Japan, promise not to invade North Korea if China will get the weapons out of North Korea? Why a deal could not be reached, a similar deal?
Yeah, well that's actually what the North Koreans want. And
yes,
this is why they talk about this, that the negotiations should be all about the peace treaty. Let's negotiate a non-aggression pact. We will not invade you. We will not invade each other. That is actually part of the deal. It's been on the table now for a couple of decades.
Right.
So you could do that. That is a desired end state. Could you do that right away? Probably not.
Thank you.
But you could do it in stages. You could reach this kind of interim agreement to freeze the programs in exchange for U.S. reduction of military exercises, for example, with South Korea, the loosening of some sanctions. So you'd have to build up a little bit of, I hate to use this word, but sort of trust. Well, let's call it equities. You have to build up some equities between the parties before you could make the final deal that would include a peace treaty and a denuclearization of the peninsula.
Peter Lawrence, yeah.
I'll add to that. One thing we never talk about with the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis was the other half of the deal, which was we had to remove our missiles from Turkey that were pointing at Moscow. And it was those missiles that inspired Khrushchev to put his in Cuba.
But this is the Cuban. Sorry,
I'm connecting this to the Saad issue.
He doesn't talk as fast as I do.
He
pauses
to the Saad, the missile defense system that we have in South Korea. This is a stickler for China.
Yeah.
So I'm just putting on the table the chips that have to be played with, because this is one of the chips. So yes, China can bring North Korea to the table with the United States to talk. They've done it many times before, actually. Mm-hmm. But definitely the conditions will be the removal of the Saad system, which came up again under the previous administration, the Obama administration. That was another decision. Another point about radicalization of regimes. If I recall my history, Castro wanted direct relations with the U.S. and wanted to do business.
Yes.
He was not a radical communist. He was actually a capitalist with, you know, communist fatigues. His brother was in between, and it was really Che Guevara who was the more radical. And it was because of our refusal to recognize and to work with that the radical side took influence. So again, the more we alienate, the more we radicalize.
The Cuban story is also a cautionary tale, because with its resolution, marked the beginning of Khrushchev's downfall.
That's a very important point. And another point that comes to my mind is what the political scientists call enforceability. If you reach a deal, how do you make sure that the other side will uphold the deal? The North Koreans, of course, worry that once they have dismantled their program, who is going to tell the United States to live up to its part of the deal, which is not to invade? In fact, once the United States can be completely confident that you are now denied any means of retaliation, then the United States will actually feel more comfortable in invading you. And some people therefore asked whether or not we knowingly invaded Iraq, knowing that they did not precisely have weapons of mass destruction. Had we known that they had them, maybe we would have paused, right? So the question of enforceability is very important. The next question we have is, again, a very good question. How much confidence do we have in the intelligence that we have about North Korea?
Oh, yeah. So I've had top secret clearance for many years. I don't think I still have it. It's as part of my duties on the International Security Advisory Board, we took briefings and things, and you'd be surprised how much we know. We have exquisite intelligence about many, many programs around the world. So when you heard, for example, in Syria that the U.S. knew which airfield had done the strikes, I think even which plane had done the strikes, that was completely believable to me. I can't verify that. I can't say that that's true, but we know a lot. North Korea is probably our toughest case, and the reason is we don't have human intelligence there. So there's a lot of stuff you can't see, you know, inside rooms yet. You need somebody in the top leadership to be telling you what the discussions are among the top five, and we don't have that. And insofar, and the Chinese, by the way, are in the same situation. So a lot of their sources have been killed. So they know less about what's going on. But we know a lot about the program, about their capabilities, about how much material, about the missile systems they're developing. It's the inner workings that we don't know all as much about as we would like.
I would suggest that when the quality of our intelligence is so high and it is ignored, the danger is not in ignorance, but in ignoring the facts.
Yeah.
So when I hear, believe me, I grew up in the 60s. I did all these terrible things, of which I'm very proud. And I never saw myself as a friend of the CIA until now. but the idea of our president publicly rubbishing our intelligence community,
oh, yeah,
I find appalling. And it is extremely dangerous, and he might be the one who gets it in the neck for doing that.
Mm.
Thank you. We have two questions, both of them from students, and again, they are related to the questions we have been asking before. One of which is, how do you monitor and track and verify any kind of agreement should one be reached to freeze the North Korean program? Do we have any way to make sure that North Korea actually abides by the terms of the agreement?
We do. And again, the Iran deal is a very good example. You know, we, the United States, have set up international agencies over the decades for precisely this purpose. So we established the International Atomic Energy Agency to do this, to go check on other people's peaceful uses of nuclear technology and make sure they weren't being used for weapons. And over the years, as people cheated on the agreement, we got smarter and smarter. The Iran agreement is the most highly verifiable agreement I've ever seen. I mean, we have sensors and monitors and testing and all over the nuclear facilities of Iran. We have, again, exquisite intelligence on what Iran is doing, and that's not even accounting for the covert intelligence operations we have over the Iran system. So you could do the same in North Korea. You could set it, and you'd have to. In fact, when we had an agreement with North Korea, remember, we reached agreement in 1994 that froze their plutonium program. This is how they were making their bombs, the plutonium route. Iran was highly enriched uranium, North Korea plutonium. We froze their program, and we had very good intelligence on that. And through our covert intelligence, we knew they were cheating on it back in 2000, 2001, 2002. We knew they were cheating by starting to set up centrifuges. And so when we confronted them with it in 2003, we understood what they were doing. You could have a verification system that could do this. And the trick would be to you make the deal, and you got to do this kind of thing in step by step. They do what they promise to do. We do what we promise to do. They do step two. We do step two. They do step. You got to build it up so that nobody's going all in all at once, because neither side's going to do that.
Any additional comments to this one is to the panel, but I think, Lawrence, you have mentioned before that the United States is the solution, because maybe you should be the first one to answer this question from the student. Do you feel that the United States could defuse the situation in North Korea without the help of another country? If so, how?
Well, you need China to bring the parties together.
Yeah.
And again, I'll just...
Okay, the question is, can the United States defuse the situation alone without the help of another country?
China is the player that will bring America and North Korea together. And this has happened before. It was with the six-party talks. And we were in a similar situation. And actually what North Korea wanted was direct talks with the United States, mm-hmm. with our country. And we did not want that. So China diffused the situation by creating a six-party talks, which brought everybody around the table. And effectively, I remember Li Jiaxing was the foreign minister then. He came to dinner at my house. And I said, what's going to happen? And he goes, nothing. I just get everybody in the room. I told my team, talk. Listen, fall asleep if you like, but just keep them talking. And that's the most important thing, because, you know, prevent a conflict from, you know, metastasizing. And by talking, and of course, the talks went on for a long, long time. So again, it'll end up being, the outcome would be probably in Beijing, talks between North Korea, United States, China. I'm sure they'll bring Japan and other parties into the room to... icing on the cake. This is invariably the direction it would take. But ultimately, the bottom line has to be a decision on no nuclear proliferation, assurance of no regime change, and opening up of markets and opening up of economic reforms. And I'll just say, from China's perspective, the cost of labor has gone up in the Northeast, which is the main industrial area and historically the textile area. So China's either shifting to Bangladesh, India, or they're simply going to shift those businesses across the border and use North Korean cheaper labor. I think the best assurance that we're not going to invade North Korea is if we have a McDonald's and a Kentucky Fried Chicken on every street corner in Pyongyang, and we will not knock out those assets.
We'll so want we to kill them with cholesterol and stuff.
That's great.
I would suggest that while we've been criticized, I think, fairly recently in hiding behind cast of thousands in terms of allies, in putting off decision making, I think it would be profoundly wrong to suggest that we could go it alone anywhere, not only in Korea.
So another question from a student. Does the size of the United States stockpile of nuclear weapons have an effect in any way on the development of nuclear weapons in North Korea and the rest of the world?
Yes, it always has. Almost every intelligence assessment done on proliferation since the beginning, since the 50s, since the 60s, made a direct connection between our stockpiles and strategies and proclamations about nuclear weapons and what other countries did. I was privileged to interview Mohammed El-Baradei, the former head of the IAEA, right after he won the Nobel Peace Prize on stage, and he puts it this way: as long as the big boys keep their toys, the other kids are going to want them. And it's as long as we're saying that nuclear weapons are, and we have a stockpile of, let's say, we have about 4,000 in our active stockpile ready to go. If we have 4,000 nuclear weapons and we say they're essential for our security, and we have the biggest, most powerful and efficient military in the world, well, why doesn't North Korea need a couple? I mean, how do you make that argument? How do you get your kid not to smoke if you have a two-pack-a-day habit? I mean, this. So there's a. You know, when you just think of it for a minute, you get now. Is there a direct relation if we start to decrease our nuclear weapons? Does North Korea then say, okay, maybe I shouldn't build more? Well, not, it's not exactly that mechanical, but you get the overall picture here. And here's what's making it worse. You saw that, this is, I hate this saying, all options are on the table. You hear that talk all the time. Does that include diplomacy, by the way? Does that include talking to North Korea? Is that one of the options that are on the table? Where is it, in the edge of the table? President Trump had these options presented to them. And this is what nothing against the security apparatus. Here's all the things we might be able to do. And they presented them to Donald Trump. And I did an interview on this over the weekend. One of those options is the U.S. putting nuclear weapons back in South Korea. This is such a stupid idea. But you got to remember, we used to have 1,000 nuclear weapons in South Korea. People forget this. We used to have 1,000, all kinds, rockets, airdrop bombs. We even had my favorite nuclear weapon, the nuclear bazooka. It was called the Davy Crockett. It was a recall-less rifle. This would fire a small nuclear shell, like a bulbous little bomb, about a half a mile. Now, why anyone would want to fire an atomic bomb a half a mile?
Are they available locally in gun shops here?
Even the Army figured that out, and they stopped making them. But we had 1,000. So we pulled them out. Gradually, we still had several hundred, and then George H.W. Bush pulled them out in 1991 unilaterally. No treaties, no talks, just said we don't need these anymore and pulled them out permanently. And so now there's talk of putting some back in, like this is going to be a security assurance. This is going to show South Korea that we got their back. We'd have to, this is stupid. One, we don't have facilities for putting them in. There's no secure facilities, no hardened bunkers. We don't have an agreement to put them in. The South Koreans, there's no diplomatic agreement. And quite possibly the new South Korean government is going to be more against having these in than the current South Korean government. And third, you put these things in. What do you think North Korea is going to do? They're going to say, oh, what were we thinking building nuclear weapons? You know, and yet this is one of the options that is prominently on the table. This is one of the options that Donald Trump is now weighing.
I'm going to try to get as many questions in as possible. So I'm going to combine two questions into one. How much leverage does China have over the U.S. and vice versa as a result of all the debt that the United States owes to China? And do you know anything of substance that came out of the discussions at the recent meeting in Florida? Any takers? Leverage, bargaining leverage, who has more over whom?
I'd like to start with mentioning the meeting that just occurred. I think the import of the meeting was that the meeting occurred.
Mm-hmm.
It was extremely important that I think Xi Jinping really wanted the meeting to occur. I think he does not want to inflame the United States in any way. I would actually make the case that no country in the world has a larger stake in America's success than China.
Yes.
Because they are our biggest investor. Rather than saying talk about debt, talk about faith in America. I mean, there's something really odd about this. They give us a lot of money. The Chinese give us tons of money. And we're sort of like, oh, God, the yellow peril. I mean, there's something really very racist and inappropriate about this. They're really banking on America. And I'm very happy that the meeting occurred. And I'm equally happy that Trump stood back from his opinion on Taiwan. Because if you want to talk about a dangerous place in the world that leaves North Korea in the dust, I would suggest it's Taiwan. We could talk about that another time. Taiwanese independence will cause the invasion of Taiwan by the mainland. And we have a treaty with Taiwan, by the way. So you want to talk danger? That's it.
Anyone else? Yeah. Okay. Have you considered that the recent assassination of Kim's half-brother was a deliberate sabotage to divert to reduce the chances of any kind of talk between the United States and North Korea. Again, maybe I'm not. I should be speaking to the microphone. Did you consider the recent assassination of Kim's half brother as a deliberate attempt to sabotage the chances of any agreement between the two sides?
No, I don't think that's it. Because we know that the North Koreans want to talk to us. I mean, we have one of the things Plowshares Fund does is finance what we call Track 2 talks, where U.S. former officials, experts, will meet with North Koreans. We used to do this for Iran, too. We still do. And so we know the North Koreans want to talk to us, and they've been floating various formula for doing this. So I don't think that's it. I don't think you have to go conspiracy theory for a lot of these things. I'm telling you, this is Michael Infredo. He knocked the guy off. He was a threat to the throne. You got to get rid of the guy. And the fact that it brushes back China, the fact that it demonstrates that he's willing to do stuff like use VX, that he has VX, that's an added. This is all about toughness, and don't screw around with me.
It's also interesting because the brother who was bumped off was an older brother. So that made him more dangerous.
Mm. Of course. It was purely, I just say, pure palace politics in the classic sense.
I'm going to try to get two more questions in. The first of the two is this. If North Korea's acquisition of nuclear weapons makes it more likely that Japan and South Korea will also follow suit, doesn't that make China more interested in trying to rein in North Korea's program?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes, I'm going to be real clear on this, real quick. I used to be, I used to talk about the Asian nuclear reaction chain, and in non-proliferation circles, we always say, you know, nuclear dominoes. If one country gets a nuclear weapon, then others will automatically follow it, and, you know, and that's the danger. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Well, guess what? North Korea got a nuclear weapon in 2006, and nobody else has gotten one yet. So this is nothing automatic. About this. There's nothing automatic. There's lots of things you can do to contain it, to reassure our allies. But this is why you don't want North Korea to have an ICBM that can hit the United States with a nuclear warhead. It's not that they're actually going to do it, but that deterrence factor then just increases by orders of magnitude. And that shakes Japanese and South Korean faith in our alliance, and that starts to increase their calculations. And right-wing parties in South Korea and Japan are already calling for this. It used to be taboo. You couldn't say this. You can say it now. So yes, this there's nothing automatic about an Asian nuclear reaction chain, but it could spiral out of control.
Right. Peter and Lawrence, you want to add anything? No? Okay, yeah. But in the Middle East, that hasn't happened yet.
Right.
After Israel's nuclearization, right?
Right.
Egypt and Syria and the rest of
it's a factor you have to be aware of, but it's not automatic.
Right. So one last question. It pertains to all of you. Someone asked, what are your college degree and academic credentials? Someone would like to know about your background, academic background, and do you agree that the importance of liberal education is to teach students to think?
Real quick. I'm the least qualified person here. I got a degree in psychology at Boston College, which turns out is really useful with the current situation. And then I got a master's of international security at Georgetown University.
As an undergraduate, I studied international relations, and I got obsessed with China before there was any reason to. I wasn't practical. I was a dreamer. It's the only time in my life I've been ahead of the curve. And then I got my doctorate from Princeton in East Asian Studies, and really I'm obsessed with the classics.
Good, thank you. Yes, Lawrence.
I have a JD in law from the University of Hawaii and a master's degree in Asian politics and economics from there, where I studied also at the East-West Center under Victor Lee, who was one of the early architects of U.S.-China policy, the translator for the ping pong diplomacy, and also a master's in law from Hong Kong University as well.
Great. Well, thank you very, very much, the panelists.
You got it.
And thank you, the audience.